I'm Cray Beaumont Flynn. Welcome to Beyond the Design, a show that gives you a peek behind the curtain of the design industry and shares the stories of those that are the driving force behind it. Well, welcome to Beyond the Design. And today we have with us Paul Grothaus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here. Cray, correct?
Yes, Cray. No worries. I get all sorts of different names. So yeah, Cray it is. Well, I'm just going to kick it off and ask you, what sparked your interest in woodworking and how did your experience of using a portable sawmill as a teenager shape your career path?
My woodworking career goes back a very long way to when I was a very young child. My father was a very fine woodworker, self-taught. He never did it for money. He restored a house that was built in 1710 with my mother. When they bought it, people were keeping chicken and goats in the house. I now own this house. But it took him about 28 years to restore it. And, you know, in a house that old, it had been through a lot of different design periods. They had replaced the moldings with Victorian style bullseyes. And so my father went through and remade all the millwork and moldings and wainscot that was stolen out of the house or changed. And, you know, spent many years doing that. And I was, you know, I had pictures of me sitting on his lap when I'm like a year old while he's, you know, scraping paint off a piece of wainscoting on a wall. And so, it was a labor of love for my father and mother at house. But my father also built, antique, like Chippendale, and Philadelphia style, like traditional furniture, high boys, ball and claw carved feet, chairs, you know, drop leaf tables. He had a great many pieces that he built and,
quite the craftsman then.
Yeah. Where I'm from, it's not really a lot of like, you know, sawmills or lumber shops or places to get lumber. So I grew up in a very rural area of Virginia called the Eastern Shore. It's across the bay from most of Virginia. Most people don't even realize it's part of Virginia. Currently, even today, I think it's only 40,000 people in two counties. But my father would go out and collect the trees and he would get them sawn in a sawmill and dry them up himself. And that's where he got, very wide walnut and things like that to build these, pretty fantastic pieces of furniture. Not necessarily my style of construction or design, but, very traditional. My father was an engineer. He really studied the books and really built very period oriented pieces. And I actually ended up working in the construction business to pay for college and, actually ended up working with a guy who was in construction and had a sawmill. And then he and I were cutting trees down and he was topping trees about 38 feet up in a tree. And he climbed the tree to cut the top and he fell right on 2 feet and crushed like 3 vertebrae. And I drove him to the hospital in his crappy little truck he had with it. He was so happy it had 400,000 miles on it. And after a couple of years, I was in college at that point and he asked me if I would like to buy the sawmill. It was one of the original Woodmisers, which Woodmiser is really the company that invented portable sawmilling and probably one of the largest sawmill manufacturers in the United States at this point. At the time, they were a very boutique, company addressing a very specific part of the sawmill industry focused on like homesteaders. So it was a manual machine. I learned a lot about sawing from Dan. He was originally from Pacific Northwest, and he had moved to the Virginia, and he taught me a lot about sawing. And he asked me if I wanted to buy the mill, and I was still in college, and I was like, yeah, I'll buy it. And it came in a lot of pieces because he pulled it apart, and I reassembled it. And when I moved to Pennsylvania, I brought it with me, and I did it on the side while I was working at Lutron. So. That's how I got in the sawmilling business, but I love it. I still love sawmilling, but I don't do it anymore.
A side gig.
It was a side job. Is basically what I did. I did it to make extra money and because I love woodworking and I love wood. I remember at my my choice came down between Lutron and Harris Electronics, which is located in Melbourne, Florida. And I remember being at the interview in Melbourne, Florida, and looking around and going, there's no trees here. There's like no trees. It's just all sand. It's flat and no brush. Trees. Yeah. And, you know, I never really lived in a place that had no trees. And, you know, so that I actually, that was a, definitely a factor in my decision to move to Pennsylvania instead of Florida. So that was,
well, share with us how your engineering background has influenced your approach to woodworking and your business management of grow house.
So, you know, from a professional perspective, I in college specifically focused on mechanical engineering, and I very much focused on process engineering. It was, so I kind of had an ME with a minor in, what we call industrial engineering. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember saying to one of my professors at one point, like, I should have just gone for industrial engineering because I like making things and manufacturing things. And, he said, no. He goes, an ME could do everything an IE could do. It's just, they have better math. And I was like, okay. you know, and I had, worked as a management consultant for about 3 years, while I was going to college, and I specialized, and this is where I really like honed my personal desires for my career. Like, when I went to college, all I wanted to do was work in robotics. I wanted to design and build robots and implement robots. And I chose, you know, my colleges I applied to for that specific reason. I ended up getting into some very prestigious schools that I couldn't afford. So I ended up going to Virginia Tech anyway, which I think gave me a great education. And, it was funny because people from those schools ended up working for me at Lutron, and I thought it was funny that I ended up being their boss. And I really specialized in manufacturing when I was consulting. So I worked on shop floor. I worked in heavy industry, from rubber manufacturing to, you know, shade blind manufacturing all the way up to like catfish farms, like food processing for catfish, you know, $50 million a year in catfish out of this one plant. I learned a lot about operational management, a lot about quality management, a lot about production design, efficiencies. And I realized that was, you know, it was my desire for robots really came from my desire to be involved in making things and designing systems to make things. So that's how my engineering career developed. I was one of the first. So I basically was hired at Lutron as a manufacturing engineer. I was, I think, the second manufacturing engineer that they ever hired. They really didn't know much about, you know, specifically focused manufacturing engineering. I took right off to redesigning a lot of the products that you probably see every day still to reduce cost in manufacturing, defects. You know, taking some of these dimmers from, you know, being handmade to being made one every 3 seconds kind of thing.
Right.
And I really enjoyed, that work. But what kind of happened to me is I realized, like, I really had this dream of, you know, being a, you know, CEO or COO of some big manufacturing company. And I came to realize that I really, really did not enjoy the politics of large corporate America. I was pretty good at it, but it was not, I felt it was very counterproductive to the business. And counterproductive to, you know, what I wanted to do with my career. And it really kind of sapped the energy out of me. And my second job, which was running a sawmill and building wood products, you know, became very passionate to me. And I realized that I really didn't have a lot of passion for corporate America anymore. And as I was very small and I ended up leaving Lutron, I ran the business on the side and it got quite large. I think I had like 3 or 4 employees before I left Lutron. And as I left Lutron, I realized that, you know, this is really what I wanted to do. And I swore I would never have a company that was anywhere close to more than $5 million a year, which we've way, way exceeded. And I have taken my engineering background and my quality and process control, and I have used those as a very significant basis of Growth House's, essentially mission. Like, we are highly focused on quality, longevity of product design, innovation, and producing things highly efficiently and with high quality. At Lutron, and I steal this all the time, they used to have this thing they called mass customization. So you can buy a dimmer and like all these colors of all these options, but they just try to design the product so that, you know, basically it's still the same thing. It's just got a lot of bolt-ons or adjustments. And, you know, I tried to approach the business at Grothaus very much that way because I feel that it's a very good way to deliver a high feeling of service to our customers while at the same time producing a very high quality product. And, you know, we really do strive to build the best of any product segment that we introduce in the market. And it may not be the fastest. Sometimes, like for example, floating shelves, very hot for the past few years. I would say that we were probably a year and a half late coming to the market with our floating shelf system, but our shelf system is designed in a way that basically makes installation like a 5-minute process. And it's extremely easy. It's highly adjustable. It's very strong, but it's better than anything else in the market. But it took us time to bring the product that was the right product for our business and for our customers out because we wanted it to be right.
Right. We've done quite the transition from one spectrum to the other. So running your own woodworking business must have been quite a change. And what motivated you to make this leap? And what were some of the early challenges that you faced that you thought you knew, but it's like, well, surprises.
It's one of those things where I look back and boy, was I naive. What motivated me was like, I just really stopped enjoying corporate America. Like I really, I'm a very passionate worker. I remember, you know, the now retired CEO at the time was the VP of manufacturing and engineering, pulling me aside and saying, you know, you gotta like just chill out a little bit. He's like, you gotta just chill it down. You can't feed people in bites this big. And I was like, okay. And I was like, well, he's like, you gotta piece it out. You gotta like plan. You gotta like, you know. And I was like, why should I have to do these things? Like, this is the right thing for the business, the right thing for the customer. And he's like, yeah, but you know, people can only change so much so quickly. So the politics really bothered me. I wanted to be able to have full control. And I wanted to have a product that I was passionate about. I mean, I don't want to speak badly about Lutron. I think it's an amazing company and I love the products they build and they're all through my house and they're very innovative and they taught me a ton as a business, but they're a very large company. I mean, multiple $1 billion-a-year company. And it just, when I started there, they were about $100 million. And when I left, there were maybe $750 million a year. And like the difference in the company was palpable. I mean, it was palpable. Like I can't, like there's literally becomes a procedure for just about everything. And I felt like I wasn't able to contribute well because I couldn't get anything done because it was like running in mud is basically, or in honey is the way I felt. And I'm a doer. And that was a big part of it for me was being able to do that. And then also build a product that I was very passionate about. I think wood has a beauty and a style and a look that's created by nature, that is, you know, massaged by man, but like, it's very difficult to create that kind of beauty, in my opinion, out of plastic and metal parts. There's some beautiful things out there. Don't get me wrong. Like I think the iPhone's a beautiful design made of plastic and glass and metal parts. But you know, when you're making dimmers for people, it just doesn't have that beauty and that kind of natural uniqueness that something like wood or natural stone or, you know, something like that is going to lend. And, so that was a big part of it. That's, you know, and that's the passion, you know, the passion is important.
So Grothaus has become known for its innovation. Tell us a little bit about the inspiration behind those innovations.
Well, you know, again, we're a style-based business. We are a design business as much as we are a manufacturer. Designers are always looking to either advance their designs to create something that's very unique or a very new solution, or a new look. And I mean, quite frankly, our customers push us a lot. Like we have some amazing customers and they ask us, you know, there's a few times that, you know, hung up the phone and go, they don't really want us to do that. like we just introduced a product at KBiz that it's our Resonata finish, which is an epoxy fill system, which, you know, has definitely been in the market, but it's been mostly done by smaller manufacturers, you know, what I would call like craftsmen, small craftsmen working individually or with a couple people, to deliver the quality again and the efficiency and the systems that we bring to the table. You know, it took us a long time to get that product to where we wanted. But the designer who wanted it, he wanted to do what he called the fire and ice table. So Shugiban, which is a Japanese treatment where they burn the wood, and it almost looks like an alligator skin of burned wood, embedded in a clear epoxy. So he called it the fire and ice table. I mean, I don't know what kind of crazy dreams you have to think something up like that, but it was beautiful and amazing. And I'm not that, you know, innovative, I guess, from the beauty side, but so we have great designers and they ask us for things. And he's been asking me for that table for the last 6 years. And we finally got the product to where I felt we could deliver, and we were able to deliver. So innovation is often tied. I mean, you know, part of it is also market. You know, people, for example, we brought an anvil a number of years ago because people want more metals. People like metal finishes. You know, wood is great and stone is great, but they want metal. And people are asking us for a lot of metal accents. And part of the problem with metal accents on wood, real wood, is it moves. It contracts and expands with seasonal changes. If you put, like, for example, glue on a piece of sheet metal onto the edge of a wood top, it's going to crinkle or come off or something because the wood is moving and metal doesn't. So anvil was where we ground up the metal particles and sprayed it on in an epoxy resin. And basically it looks exactly the same as metal. But it's flexible because it has this, you know, substrate that carries the metal particles. And that's one way is we're trying to, you know, problem solve. People, for example, like the floating shelves I mentioned before, you know, people came to us and said, well, this doesn't do that. This doesn't do this. And this brand doesn't do that. And I need this. And I got to order from this guy to get that part and this and that. So we just basically became a solutions provider. There's also just a natural desire within our business by the people within it, including me, including my other engineers, including my designers, that we want to innovate. Like, we want to do the newest technologies, like, and we want to do a better job for our customers. Like, and that may not necessarily be in a product. It might be in a service. For example, we have moved completely away from mechanical templates anymore for countertops or spaces, and we use 3D scanning. I first saw that technology shown on this old house, I don't know, 15 years ago. And it was a guy who basically scanned a half broken disc, you know, decorative disc around the chandelier in a Victorian home. And then he recreated it by scanning this 3D thing and printed it. And they painted it. He printed it on a 3D printer, and he had to print it in like 6 pieces because it was, you know, printers back then weren't very big.
Right.
And they glued it together and then they painted it and it looked like plaster and they stuck it to the ceiling. And I was like, wow, that's really cool technology. I immediately started exploring it. But at the time, the accuracy wasn't enough. Like, the accuracy was very small. Like, you could scan something like an iPhone and have high accuracy. But if you try to scan, for example, something that's 3 foot by 3 foot, the accuracy was like off, like, you know, an eighth, a quarter inch, which is not big, not close enough for us. It was also extremely expensive, like to the order of the technology at the time, I think it was about $250,000 for the scanner. And, you know, so it just didn't. Now, we ended up buying a new version of the scanner about a year and a half ago. The scanner we bought cost $50,000. So the price come down about a fifth. It's still a very expensive piece of equipment. But the accuracy is like 1/64th over, I think it's 16 feet or 20 feet. So we now can walk in a room and scan the cabinets and everything within the room with this in a matter of minutes. And we have a full 3D picture of the entire room. And it's accurate. We can bring it up in a CAD software. It's accurate. It's highly accurate compared to even using mechanical templates. You have,
right,
you have error, you know, with pencil marks and people marking and stuff. So, like, that's an example where, you know, I saw coming a long time, and that technology is really growing by leaps and bounds. I mean, the majority of people don't have access to the kind of accuracy we do. But like, for example, if you've seen like those 3D walkthroughs, those are basically 3D scans. They're done on a scanner, costs about $5,000, and they have to set it every 6 feet apart. And it's not very accurate. It's designed for photo, like walkthrough, but it's essentially a 3D scanner. And so you see those technologies implemented in different ways. And like, I have one builder, he uses those on every home that he builds before he sheetrocks or insulates. He goes through and takes those scans in every room so that he can see where the wires are, the pipes. So if they have to come back later, they can go, okay, you know, here we did that, here we did this. They can look at the scan and see where, you know, I've done it in very custom projects myself, where I walk around with a, you know, video camera or my iPhone for like 3 hours and, you know, scan every room, but then you're going back through, you're like forward. Oh, I missed that part. Whereas a 3D scan gets everything. So, you know, a lot of it is just, you know, our desire to innovate and, you know, our desire to improve our service level, but also to do things more efficiently for our customers. So it's not always product. It's also the way we do business.
Well, given that over the years, how have you seen customer preferences and industry trends shift, and how has Grouthouse adapted to those changes?
Styles change, but they always come back around. For example, you know, before the downturn of 2007, 2008, whichever year you want to count it, you know, reds were highly popular in style. Like, people loved cherry, they loved mahoganies. After that downturn, people moved to very dark gray and tan and brown and black tones. We see almost no red being asked for by our customers anymore. I mean, there's a small percentage, but essentially the object is to get those, you know, those more, you know, brown, dark, light, white, like, but no red, no orange, no yellow. So that's a style. That's a stylistic change. I know that it eventually will come back around, but you know, those kind of things do create challenges for us as a manufacturer because, for example, if you know, our solution for dark cabinets before that was always to put a mahogany top or to put, you know, a cherry top on, you know, a black painted cabinet or dark stained cabinet. Well, that doesn't work anymore if nobody wants any red. So you're in a situation where, you know, are we trying to match the color of the cabinet? Or, you know, because if you put a walnut countertop on a black cabinet, it kind of doesn't really look that great. So we had to introduce new species and things like that to solve those problems. We brought out Saxon wood, which has, it's, you know, got a light and a dark pattern, and it's very, very, very popular for that application. So we do have to, you know, maneuver and do things like that. Also, you know, edge treatments, things like edge treatments. People don't really want ornate edge treatments anymore. I mean, we really, when we came out with Grouthouse initially, like, we really hung our shingle on the fact that we were producing some of the largest edge treatments in the industry. I mean, I'm sure you guys have all seen, you know, the old double page ad in AD with the Clyde Christian big thick edges. Like, we were one of the innovators of that. We were the people that put that into the business. That product is non-existent today. Like, I shouldn't say non-existent, but you know, out of 150 jobs a week, we might do two a year, you know, where we used to do a large percentage of those. Nobody really wants big ornate moldings or edges right now. So that changes the way we do business because the machining capability to do those kinds of edges is very involved. And, you know, we, you know, are always building for efficiency. So that's, you know, an area where we have to change. As far as, you know, but I can see that that one's starting to come back. I think that's, that is actually starting to come back. People are quoting it again. So it's, but also like how we do business. I mean, people continually expect improvement in performance and design. You know, whereas, you know, in the 2000s, I used to be like, oh, just do an oil finish. Then people got, well, I want something more protection. So then we brought out Dorada, which took us a long time. And then people say, well, you know, I want more metal accents. So we bring out Anvil. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. I mean, the Resonata product is, I really got me excited because I see ways to do things with wood with that product that we never even imagined. So there's an opportunity there to do so much more that we aren't even thought about before. So, I'm excited about that. And that's a product that a lot of people have interest in. And
you've worked with a good amount of top designers and high profile clients, as well as being featured in major publications, television shows. That must be very rewarding. Can you share a project or collaboration that stands out to you as particularly memorable?
I mean, a lot of them have been very memorable for me. I'll be honest, the first time we were on this old house was really quite amazing to me. To have Norm Abram come to our shop, who was a woodworker that my entire life I had idolized, to come to my shop and chit-chat with me about cars and woodworking. That was a pretty surreal moment. And even, you know, installing that top, going up there and installing it, and, you know, meeting Kevin and at the time Roger and, you know, and, you know, Rich Tithui, and they all helped carry the top in because it was gigantic.
They're icons.
I mean, yeah, but, you know, they're not icons for everyone, but they're icons for people who work with their hands. And they were icons for me. And, it, you know, it's ironic because I actually, we've done this old house 6 seasons, I think, in total. And I still love it. I love the product. I love the company. But actually, the marketing team brought up to me last year, and they're like, "Do you think we're too high end to do this old house anymore?" And I was like, "Wow, that's a really interesting perspective." And you know, it really took me back, and I could appreciate where they were coming from with that, because this old house, despite the fact that there are some of those remodels are multi-million-dollar remodels, you know, they brand themselves as a do-it-yourself company, and you know, so that's, you know, again, you talk about transition in the business. It was really something that really kind of took me back. I was like, oh, you know, like Christopher Peacock would never work on this old house. Mick DiGiulio would never work on this old house. Karen Williams would never work on this old house. And these are the people we work with every day. Right. And I kind of have to sit there and go, okay, you know, but for me, that was a very, very surreal moment. It was a validation of the quality of my work to me. I don't know if it was to the public, but for me to be featured on that show was a validation of my level of skill, like that literally was unmeasurable to me at that time, you know.
As they say, you've made it.
You never made it, Craig. You just fight bigger demons. That's all. Right. You know, if it's easy, you're just not fighting a big enough demon.
With your extensive experience, how do you foresee the future of custom woodworking and design evolving next decade, 20 years, even in, you know, 5 years time, in a short amount of time?
So, I mean, from the standpoint of woodworking, there's so much innovation going on right now. It is insane. Mm-hmm. Like, particularly, you know, the big woodworking show for me is International Woodworking Fair, which is held in Atlanta every 2 years. It's held this year. It's in August. If you're a woodworker, go see it. It'll change your life. And I've gone to that for, I don't know, the last 20 years minimum. And it was closed in 2020. And, so we went 4 years without it. And in 22, when they had it, I was like, wow, like so much has changed. And really what's changing is now is the digital integration with the machinery. So it's not that the machine processes are changing that much, or the capabilities of the machines to do a physical process has changed that much. It's the integration of the smarts to it. It's the, for example, they now have wide belt sanders, which you guys probably know what wide belt sander is. It's a very powerful sander, sanding flat surfaces. And like a cabinet door, they call it a 5-piece cabinet door because it has 4 sides and then it has the center panel. So it's 5 pieces. So the grain on the door runs vertically on the sides and horizontally on the top and horizontally on the bottom. And on the panel usually runs vertically. So if you put that through a wide belt, you get all these cross grain scratches in the old days on the top pieces. Or the panel might be down and it just sands the side and it doesn't sand the panel, or the panel might be up and the panel gets sanded but not the sides. Well, they're now, you put these doors on these wide belts and they scan them as they go in so they know where they are, and they use a crossbelt head with servos to drive down the sanding belt that sands the horizontal parts. And then another step, it does the sides. And then the third step, it like can push it down into the panel and sand the panel all in one pass. Like, and it's sanded amazingly. It looks beautiful. And like you, like it's the same technology they've always had on the machines, but now they're using the smarts with scanning and to do things like that. I mean, to me, that's just, it's just game changing to actually have that kind of smarts to do that. And like, you know, I was looking at spray lines, you know, in the old days, you want to, or not in old days, but, you know, say 6 or 7 years ago, you want a flat line finishing system. It, you know, essentially the things just go across, just go and the sprayer stuff.
Right.
And there's a lot of overspray and they don't spray the sides and there's like, so now they've got a robot that literally I could put in a countertop that's the shape of the United States with the lakes inside, and it'll go and it'll spray the edges. It'll go around the whole United States, spray the edges, it'll spray the inside holes, and then go and finish the top. And it scans as it goes in. So again, like these are technologies that have existed, and but they're just putting so much smart. And ultimately, you know, the way I see our business developing is like we have such difficulty finding labor today, particularly people that want to like work physically with their hands, that, you know, these systems will basically be used to replace that skill because we have to, because either labor is A, too expensive, or B, not available, which is both, you know, so it's like, so that's how woodworking technology is evolving for us. And additionally is like, it's on the design side. I mean, we're able to design things in 3D using software that I could never have designed on a piece of paper. You know, and, you know, I went from hand drafting to AutoCAD to now, you know, 3D modeling, and we use SolidWorks primarily. Like we do stuff like integration of supports, you know, and it, with parametric technologies, we're able to adjust. Like people would say, oh, well, I need to change this from, you know, 32 and an eighth to, you know, 33 and a quarter. You just done the design updates like that. Like the technology is moved so fast, and it allows from a design perspective to do so much more. So that's really where the innovation has been in my mind in the woodworking business and how it's changing things. I mean, as far as product goes, like in the way the style is, I think it's just giving people a flexibility to communicate better and to better create really awesome things together, you know, between designers and manufacturers over time.
Right. Well, one of the key factors now is sustainability and is a growing concern in all industries, especially, you know, including woodworking. How does Grauthaus address sustainability in its practices and products?
So sustainability has always been very important to me. I struggle with the rubber stamps of sustainability, things like LEEDs and things like that, because I think they're counterproductive to actually creating a sustainable system. And, you know, we've always worked to in our product. I mean, wood is one of the few products where I feel very comfortable about the fact that we're replacing every tree that we cut down with about 2.1 trees. So it's one of the few industries ever, particularly in the U.S., that has a lot of success with sustainability of the raw material. The USDA has done amazing things since the 50s with the Forest Service. A lot of people don't realize the Forest Service is underneath the USDA. Like we have literally got to the point where we're replacing every tree with 2.1 trees, and that was in like 2000. It's better now. And really the biggest threat to forests is not harvesting and using and building wood products. It's actually expansion of, like land development. So the U.S. is better than most, but if you look at other countries like Brazil and places where they talk about the rainforest, a lot of people, you know, get really upset talking about the rainforest and say, you shouldn't use these woods and you shouldn't do that. But that's not really why the rainforest is failing. The rainforest is failing or getting cut down because farmers in those countries, what they do is they burn the forest And then that puts nitrogen in the ground. The burning, the ash, puts nitrogen in the ground, and they plant it. And guess what? They don't do any fertilization. They don't do any sustainability or crop rotation. And they're within 2 years, they're not producing as much. So they just burn some more forest and plant it again. And, you know, so like it's like timbering and log harvesting is actually a highly sustainable industry. It's the, you know, the destruction of forest lands is generally speaking more related to, you know, us as humans and agriculture. So you'll see there's a lot of initiatives now in a lot of these third world countries and rainforest to teach them how to use fertilizer, to offer fertilizer loans, things like that to minimize the, you know, cutting down and burning down of rainforest. But in the US, we don't have that problem. Like that's, so if you use US species, you can feel confident. And then we have a lot of products, things like reclaimed woods, like coming out of old barns. I mean, it's funny how expensive that stuff is now. It's more expensive than regular wood and it's highly in demand. It's funny because I talk to the farmers around here and they're like, well, I guess I should not push that barn down with a dozer and set it on fire. That's what they do. And it's like, you know, I mean, at least in their minds now, they at least don't do that anymore because there's got enough guys that buy up the barns and clean them up. So there's always those options. I feel like, you know, we make a lot of sustainability choices. I mean, we generate about a third of our power via solar systems on our property. We utilize finishes that are formaldehyde free. They use a different reaction than that. And that creates, you know, no VOCs after the product is sprayed. You know, we make a lot of choices, like with energy and reusing of scraps. Like we make all of our end grains from scraps. We grind any defective pieces of wood, like whether it's a knot or a split or something like that, and we mix it with sawdust and we compress them into briquettes that we sell for firewood. Most companies just put that stuff in the dumpster. We can't give our sawdust away because the species we use, particularly walnut, makes horses founder. And so nobody wants our sawdust, like a farmer or anything. So that's a way that we can, you know, utilize that. And again, you know, you have to remember when you're using wood products, like you're basically, storing CO2 from the environment. You know, as trees get mature, they use less and less CO2 as they grow to maturity. And that's why we support selective harvesting, go in and harvest the older trees. And so the younger trees can then push the canopy up and produce better quality timber and better lumber. And again, encapsulate more CO2. I mean, people should feel good about using wood products to, you know, to basically, it's a lot better than using petroleum-based products or even mined products. Like, you know, I mean, if you ever go to Italy, check out the mountain where marble comes from. I mean, it's literally like a mountain range and it's cut up. And listen, there's a lot of it. There is a lot of it. And they've been harvesting it there since the Romans.
Romans time. Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a lot of it. And it's a small part of the world that they're making. I mean, it's big when you look at it, but, it looks like you're looking across the world when you look at it, but it's a small part of the world. But again, they're mined. Like they're not growing any back. They're using a lot of diesel and electricity to harvest those, to cut and polish those. You know, wood is a great product. If people want to buy sustainable products, buy things made out of wood, particularly made out of U.S. wood, not stuff made overseas. Like,
what inspires and motivates you?
That has changed for me over time. Today, I would say what inspires me more than anything is my employees, seeing them grow, seeing them become something more than they were. That inspires me and I really enjoy it. It's something that gives me a lot of personal satisfaction to see, for example, my vice president of manufacturing, he's a farm boy from, you know, down in Kempton, and he's worked for me since he was 17 and he's smart as a whip. And, I sent him to a management seminar, and, you know, he's a guy who wears like a, you know, ball cap every day and a t-shirt, and he's like all worried. And I was like, you'll be fine. I said, we give you great tools. And he went there, and he's young. I mean, he's like 35. And he's like in this room with all these guys in their 50s and stuff. And he goes, I knew more about managing people and business than they came even close to. I said, I know. I said, you know, we do a good job here. And to give people the tools to grow, for me, that is tremendous satisfaction for me. I enjoy seeing people do that. I enjoy seeing people, you know, grow their families. I'm proud of the fact that almost every one of my employees owns their own home. So I really do care a lot about my employees. I also get a lot of satisfaction from the relationships I have with customers. Some of these designers I've worked with for 25 years, 26 years, 27 years, like our first dealer is Bluebell Kitchens down in Philadelphia. And to watch their business transition, I mean, they've made huge, huge transitions in the last 10 years. And to be, you know, along for the ride with them and them along for the ride with us is, it's funny because, like, you know, Peter Cardamone, the owner, he and I laugh about it. And, like, you know, he's become a design force internationally and, doing billionaires' houses and things like that. And it's just, it's almost surreal. It's just surreal. Like the relationships and the journeys that we've been through with some of our customers is mind boggling sometimes. It really is. So I would say that's where I gain the most satisfaction. The product is amazing. I still get goosebumps when I see some of the pieces. Some of the ones we really, really, you know, do something really custom on. I find those challenging. I enjoy the challenge. The innovation is challenging to me, coming up with new product ideas, developing products, to fit people's needs. That's always been a drive for me. But as I've grown older, the interpersonal relationships have gotten to be more and more important to me.
As you look back on your journey of almost nearly 3 decades in the business, what do you consider your greatest achievement and why?
Tough question. I would say my greatest achievement is my daughter. And that's just my personal. As far as professionally, I think the greatest achievement that I have made is just creating a product that is so well, known and respected within the market. I mean, just, it's literally synonymous with quality. And it's almost, again, somewhat surreal because it's like, I remember literally praying and hoping that we'd be able to get certain of these designers as our customers, you know, Mick DiGiulio, Christian Peacock, I can't think of his name now, Nate Berkus, praying that I would get opportunities with these people, right. And they come to us now. We take great care of them and we care about them as customers, but it's like, it's almost like, of course they're going to buy from us. and I'm not trying to be like a cocky person about it, but it's just kind of like, we just try so hard to do such a good job for everyone that of course they're going to buy from us. It's my director of sales. He goes, we're our own worst enemy, Paul. He goes, all we do is we're so hard on ourselves. Like, why don't we do this? And why don't we do that? And like, why would you guys, leave that speck of dust on there or something, and he goes, and then, we go out and I actually purposely have to kind of stay out of the field and not see customers too much because it's just all they do is talk about how great we are. And again, I give all that to my employees. My employees make me look good every day and they make us this business run every day. Like they are the heart of this business more so than me. I set the direction, but they follow it. And I appreciate that of them. And, I don't want to minimize that, but it's just, it can really get you make you cocky to go out and see it in public a lot. They just did a Legends of Kitchen Design conference at KBiz. I don't know if you were there or not.
I missed it this year.
They had Christian Peacock, Mick DiGiulio, and Richard Januszkiewicz. Now Richard's kind of the new guy. And I do a lot of work with Richard and I'm a good friend of Richard's and I'm good friends with Mick and Chris too. And they're literally just, they have this collage running in the background of all of their designs. And it's just like, and my director of marketing counted, it was something like 40 pictures. And of the 40 pictures, I think 36 of them had our product in it. And it, these are the kitchens like you can't even imagine. And like, you know, it, to just be, to be even breathing the same air as those people, in my mind, is credit enough to where we, to what we've done.
You're also, on a personal level, committed to educating young craftsmen and developing quality woodworkers is commendable. Why do you believe that is an important factor for you to have that part of your...
Well, listen, not everybody's going to be a lawyer, not everybody's going to be a doctor, not everybody's going to be an engineer. And that's okay. And we need people to not all be those things, because we actually have a significant problem in this country with trades, tradesmen, trades ladies, trades people. Like, I'm not kidding you. Like, we won't have enough electricians or plumbers in the next 20 years. We just won't. And you can say what you want about immigration or whatever. We do not have enough of a clean path for people either to come into the trades from out of this country, or for young people to grow into the trades and still feel respected. So what you see is, generally speaking, the population, the populace, you know, with their children, expects mm-hmm. their children to go to college, whether that's a good fit for their child or not. And I'm a believer in college. Don't get me wrong. I think it provides an experience, and particularly a worldly experience, that most people don't understand unless they've gone to college. Like, to be hanging out with people from, you know, Asia or India or Europe in the same classes and making friends with those people, and that experience, I think, is worth more than the classes itself. And having to communicate and, you know, experience some of those things. Like, I always tell the story in college, like, when people ask me what's college, like, I remember going to a party in an apartment, and me and my friend were at this party for like 3 hours, and I was like, is this the right party? I don't know anybody here. And we were like hanging out and talking to these people and everything. And they're like, we're like, is this, you know, I can't remember the girl's name's apartment. They're like, no, she's upstairs. She's one floor up. They're like, oh, okay. We go up to that party. But it's not like anybody even said a word to us. Like, it's just, we're hanging out, meeting new people. And it's like, right. That's what college is like. Life is not like that. College is like that. But I feel like there is definitely a push among most parents to push their children into college. And there are great jobs available for people in the trades. I mean, great jobs. Like, you can make more money than people go to college and make. And, you know, so it's like, I really do care about tradespeople. Like, you know, I paid my way through college building houses. I was a framing carpenter. I understand what it's like to lay bricks, or, like, you know, carry 500 cinder blocks in a day. Like, I know what that life is like. And it makes you respect things, I think, in a way that, and I have a respect for tradespeople, because they just are real. They're real people who understand, like, what it takes. You know, you can look at these beautiful homes and go, oh, you know, that cost $5 million or whatever. But, you know, what about the guy who had to, like, pour the footing or right. dig the footing? And I try to help, particularly with the students feeling of being less than in the trades. And, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with the VOTEC about this. Like, you know, essentially the schools using the VOTECs as a dumping ground for their problem children. And that's not okay. And I made a lot of changes to that. Like, when I was there, I'm not actually on the board anymore, but, because, you know, what you'd see is a classroom of woodworking kids, and, you know, three of them would be the problem. And they're basically the kids that didn't really test into woodworking. They didn't want to be in work. They got shoved in there because there were some spaces available. And that's what the school system does. And that's not okay. And, you know, and I hope that some of the work I did helped reduce that, at least. But, you know, the educators, the schools are very slow. Like, they do not respond quickly to new technologies, because the educators don't have time to learn them. They're too busy, you know, maintaining the kids and keeping them busy to be learning about, you know, resin pouring or, you know, programming a CNC. And maybe it's not the right class anyway. Why is a woodworker guy programming a CNC? That should probably be the CAD class that's doing that. So right. I try to work a lot on, you know, discipline, you know, projects. And the Votech I work with, they did a house every 2 years, and that was really good. They, you know, had the framers and the plumbers. But, you know, it's just we're in trouble in this country with tradespeople. Like, I build a new garage, and every guy, and I have great trades, I have great subs, but they're all 50 and 60 years old. I mean, they got a couple of new kids that like sweep the floor or something, but they're we're in trouble. Like, we are in trouble. And, you know, the way companies are still dealing with it is they're using immigrants, like, but most of them are illegal. Whether you like to admit it or not, like the guy who poured my slab, he had like 40 guys here. And I said, he goes, well, I don't employ any of them. They're employed by a so he has one guy who's got, you know, who's an American citizen, and he employs all these guys under a separate corporation, and he hires that corporation. So he can't get nailed, you know, and that's how they do it. Mm-hmm. And like the government does not, you know, allow a path for that. And, you know, whatever side of politics you sit on, you know, we need people to do this work in this country. We really do. Right. And we're going to have a real problem. I mean, it's not going to matter how much money you have. You're not going to be able to get something done.
Are there any upcoming? Oh, go ahead.
So that's why I feel very passionate about it. I feel passionate about it for a number of reasons. I think we're going to have a problem in this country. And I think I also do not like the stigma that is placed on doing, you know, craftsman work versus office work. I'm not proud of our country for doing that.
Well, I think there's a creative passion that is not relayed to someone that is a craftsman or works with their hands. It's looked upon as a downgrade, I think, in society sometimes. You know, it takes a lot of craft and skill set to work with your hands and create things.
Yes. And
a lot of people don't understand that. It's not a subset of society or profession. It's as elevated as anything else because you are creating with your hands and you are creating that mindset of from your mind to your hands and creating objects. And I think it's part of a society's problem of downgrading craftsmen in a level that doesn't seem appealing to younger generations.
100%.
Are there any upcoming projects or innovations at Grout House that you're particularly excited about?
I'm very excited about our new Resonata line. The basic expansion of capabilities with the introduction of these deep pour resins and the colors and the patterns and things that can be done are just, it's like having a whole new like canvas to paint on that you didn't have before. To me, it really actually has livened me up, like technically, to really think outside the box and develop things that, you know, people haven't seen yet.
So what's next for Paul and Grout House?
Grout House is, you know, continually focused on delivering high quality products for our customers. And we want to really push our brand to be more well known within the consumer's mind. Designers definitely know who we are, but there's certainly an opportunity to teach the consumer, particularly the luxury consumer, more about who we are and what we can do, and, you know, kind of basically raise our brand awareness with those folks. As far as like production capability, we're continuously growing. We're continuously improving. This year, we're spending a ton of time on software, integrating more complex software that's more enterprise that is able to help increase communication, call out opportunities and issues more readily, and basically improve our customer experience with us and make us more efficient. We're spending you know, a lot of money on software and equipment as well to, again, as I said, to integrate more technology and more capabilities. Like, we're buying a new wide belt that will give us some crazy new texture capabilities as well. So things like that, again, just expanding the opportunities and innovation that we deliver.
What legacy do you hope to leave behind in the world of custom woodcraft and design?
I think that the primary legacy that I want to leave behind is that wood is a viable and long-term, reliable surfacing product. There's been, you know, certainly a lot of pushback, you know, on the crappily made butcher blocks of the 70s and 80s, you know, that's cheap crap and nobody wants that.
Right.
So, like, I have certainly made a mission of my life to show people that, you know, wood can be one of the most premium surfaces that you can buy and one of the most beautiful opportunities you can have for surfacing in your home or business. So if I really want to leave a legacy, like, I think we've done a pretty good job of showing people of what wood can be done, what can be done with wood. There's certainly been other companies that came to the market around the same time as us, but they haven't lasted. They're either closed or they're, you know, very small companies now. They have not delivered that level of innovation. So that's really the legacy that I want to leave. And I also, I guess, you know, just my side quest legacy is I really do care about American manufacturing, delivering a product that's made in America for a reasonable price, that's high reliability, high quality, and allows me to employ people, you know, at a living wage that can show those people who go through Votex and things like that, that they can, you know, be successful, mm-hmm. you know, working with their hands and can do some amazing things in this country.
Paul, what advice would you offer to young entrepreneurs or craftsmen just starting out and kind of maybe following your footsteps and your path?
I made a lot of mistakes, Cray.
So. Hey, trial by error. You don't learn. If you don't make mistakes, yeah. You're never going
to
learn.
If you're not getting burned, you're not high close enough to the fire, right? It's, I would say that when I started, I was very naive. I had very strong understandings of a certain part of the business from my experience corporately that I would think most entrepreneurs do not have. So I would say the most important thing you can do is to read a lot, listen a lot. There are some amazing people out there today, generating content that is really, it's remarkable. It really is motivating to me, even at the point I am in professionally. Like that, a lot of that content wasn't available to me then when I was starting out. So I really, you know, try that. I would also say, you know, be the best you can. Like, don't try to compete on price. Mm-hmm. Like, I said this to a friend of mine who's a machinist, and he was complaining to me that he wasn't making money. And I said, you have to stop taking jobs just to do the jobs. Like, if you, you know, I always have this joke, like, I'll work for free, but I won't pay to work. But a lot of entrepreneurs start out, you know, paying to work. So run a sustainable organization. Run an organization that generates revenue and profit. A lot of people just do it because they have a dream that it'll work. But if the numbers don't work, it's not going to work.
Right.
I see that with a lot of people. They're like, I want to do this and I want to do that. And I was like, okay. I'm like, you know, like whatever. Say you're opening a yoga studio and they go, well, I'm going to sell, you know, $20 sessions. Okay. Well, how many yoga sessions are you going to do a week? And they're like, well, I'll have 5 classes a week and, you know, be like 10 people in a class. I was like, okay. So that's $200 a class times 5. I go, that's $1,000 a week. I go, what's your rent and your electricity? And they're like, and I'm like, you know, your rent's $3,200.
Right.
And I see it often. I mean, a lot of people, they think just because they have a business, they will make money. And it's not, you really have to work the numbers. You have to understand the numbers and just really go out there and research what you need for business and listen to people who are willing to give you advice. Right. And don't listen to people who give you shitty, particularly negative advice. Like another one of my things is like, no one who is above you or equivalent to you will give you negative feedback. Sure. You'll never hear anyone say who's above you or equivalent to you, who's your peer, say, you know, oh, you shouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. They won't say that. What you should do moving forward is this. That's what they'll say.
Right.
Like, don't listen to your friends who are, you know, sitting there at a desk going, oh, I can't believe you're doing that. Like, that's so risky. I can't believe you're doing it. You really got to have belief and mm-hmm. and a drive to do it. So
drive and passion.
100%.
Well, sir, is there anything else you'd like to share and tell our audience?
No, I appreciate your time. I mean, I feel like I talked a lot. You not so much. So
hey,
I appreciate you.
That's why you're here.
Well, good.
We want you to talk.
I appreciate the time. And you know, if you guys get a chance, go to growthouse.com. Check us out.
Absolutely. Well, Paul, it's been a pleasure. And thank you again for coming on the show. And much continued success to you.
Thank you. You guys have a great weekend.
All right. You talk soon.
All right. Bye.